Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak here for this Wednesday, the 22nd of March in London. Coming up today...
No good choices. Jerome Powell to unveil the Fed's next move on rates after weeks of market turmoil.
Two mid-sized to fail. The rescue of First Republic may need US government support.
Solid foundations. The Chancellor says UK banks are immensely stronger than in 2008.
Boris Johnson's reckoning. Age is just a number and the EU clears house. Those are the stories we're looking at in today's papers. I'm James Walcock.
Plus, Credit Suisse pay pain. Authorities freeze deferred bonuses for bankers.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe. The business news you need to start your day in just one 15-minute podcast. On Apple, Spotify, the Bloomberg Business app, and everywhere you get your podcasts.
Good morning, I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Here are the stories that we're following today.
The eyes of the financial world are on Washington today, where the Fed Chair Jerome Powell will seek to balance the twin threats of inflation and banking instability. Markets are currently pricing in a quarter point interest rate hike. However, uncertainty over the path forward is at its highest level since the pandemic. Former World Bank Chief Economist Carmen Reinhart says she expects the Fed to opt for a rate rise.
I think it is too soon to expect that the Fed will throw in the towel, so to speak, on their inflation fighting. I think also not a complete pause may not only be counterproductive from the vantage point of the medium-term inflation objectives, but also could send the signal that they know something worse that the markets are yet to learn.
We'll find out if Carmen Reinhart is right when the decision and forecasts are released at 6 p.m. UK time. Jerome Powell will hold a press conference 30 minutes later, which we'll bring you live here on Bloomberg Radio.
Former Bank of England policymaker Danny Blanchflower says that it would be reckless for the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England to raise interest rates at their meetings this week. He told us on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe that the Fed is to blame for the recent volatility in the banking sector.
The best I suspect we can hope for is that they potentially will pause. But the reality is that they should be cutting. Any move upwards would be an enormous error. And what you'll end up seeing is screeching U-turns. And I just have to look at what markets are pricing in. Markets today in the United States are pricing in by the end of the year three rate cuts. So if they're pricing in three rate cuts, suggests that the rate rises today would be foolishness at best and disastrous at worst.
So that was the former Bank of England policymaker Danny Blanchflower. We'll have more of that interview a little later on.
Banks are pulling out of risky debt deals in the wake of financial failures around the world. Bloomberg's markets reporter Valerie Tytel has the details.
INEOS, $880 million. Agility Health, $1 billion. Russell Investments, $1.1 billion. All loans that have been pulled from the market in the past week. Underwriters are yanking sales and pausing future ones as the turmoil from Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse ripple through the market. The rising volatility and borrowing costs are hitting a junk debt market, which already had the lowest issuance in years. In London, Valerie Tytel, Bloomberg Daybreak Europe.
Well, Wall Street leaders and U.S. officials are looking at the possibility of government support in a deal to rescue First Republic Bank. Bloomberg understands that this could include lifting assets out of First Republic that have eroded its balance sheet. The news comes as the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, said that the government is prepared to repeat the drastic actions that it took recently to protect bank depositors.
Our intervention was necessary to protect the broader U.S. banking system. And similar actions could be warranted if smaller institutions suffered deposit runs that pose the risk of contagion.
Janet Yellen there speaking at the American Bankers Association summit in Washington. After Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank failed, regulators took the unusual step of covering uninsured deposits.
Here in the UK, Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt was also asked if he was concerned about growing financial risks.
The government does recognise that there is some volatility in the market, but we believe the UK financial system is fundamentally strong and UK banks are well capitalised. They now have core capital ratios that are three times higher than before the 2008 global financial crisis, but we continue to monitor the situation carefully.
Jeremy Hunt speaking to MPs in Parliament. When asked if he had issues with Swiss authorities changing their rules to allow Credit Suisse's takeover by UBS Group, Hunt said he wholly supported the decision.
And finally, deferred bonuses for Credit Suisse bankers have been frozen by the Swiss government. The news piles more pain on awards that were already decimated when the lender's share price plunged after the UBS takeover. Authorities have the power to implement the measure when systematically important banks receive state aid. Bloomberg understands that the bank can pay cash bonuses still for last year as planned. Those are a few of our top stories this morning.
Caroline, I always learn something when I read our Bloomberg opinion columnist Andrea Felsted's pieces. This morning, it's her coining of the phrase big bling to describe the luxury industry. Look, she's writing about how the downturn around banking could affect big luxury companies. In her words, when a butterfly flaps its wings on a Gucci bag in San Francisco, shoppers in Shanghai feel the breeze. So it's a redefinition of the butterfly effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think that opening line, gets best quote of the day, frankly. The super wealthy, they don't have the kind of ordinary concerns about inflation that perhaps others do and cost of living and so on. But actually, banking crises, it can, or at least some worry that it will, put those very, very wealthy, high-end consumers off, frankly, buying anything really expensive and flashy.
And that's what we saw in 2008. And it's also what we saw in China when they had their crackdown on conspicuous consumption in 2015 as well. Andrea's also pointing to the fact that things like job losses in finance and tech are actually also going to affect the brands that are more skewed towards middle-class shoppers. The likes of Hugo Boss is the sort of one that she points to as being potentially vulnerable as well. And she says that one indicator we should be looking at is the price of Rolex watches on the secondary market. They have stabilised along with Bitcoin, which is an idea of how the richest are feeling about
the squeezed sort of upper middle, I'll put it that way. Yeah, lovely piece by Andrea Felsted. Let's also talk though about really what is going to be most important today. The Fed caught between this sudden banking crisis and inflation. How will they respond? Let's bring in Bloomberg's executive editor for Asia Markets, Paul Dobson. Paul, super to have you on the programme this morning. The expectation for this Fed rate decision has been wild, frankly, for a couple of weeks. What do we think is going to happen? What will the FOMC deliver today, do we think?
Yeah, good morning, Caroline. So the base case, after all of the turmoil that we've had over the last 2 weeks or 6 weeks, is for the Fed to proceed with a 25 basis point hike. But I think that there's a lot more to it and a lot more to consider than that. So the market pricing is for an 80% probability that they will hike by 25 basis points. The range of estimates is broad, though, from a cut of 25 basis points to a hike of 50 basis points. And that tells you the spectrum of views among analysts, some of whom are very worried about the banking crisis that we've had. So others who are very worried about the inflation that we're seeing. And, you know, the Fed has to balance those two risks. And I think what will be more key than what they actually do in terms of the rate decision will be what that dot plot looks like, what the forward forecast for the peak of the Fed's hiking cycle, and when it comes, how much further do they think that they've got to go? Be really interesting. And then, of course, you know, Powell has got a difficult balancing act to pull off in the press conference as well, to reassure people about the banking risks, and that the Fed can also get inflation under control, and that we're not just in the middle of a nosedive towards a very hard landing.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting, as you say, to watch what happens in terms of forward guidance, given what the ECB said about it last week as well. Paul, I wanted to ask you about the credit markets and all of this. You know, does the US regional bank crisis cause a credit contraction or not? Or when will we know what the broader effect of that is?
You probably won't know until it's too late. I was arguing with my colleagues all morning about which is more important for macro markets right now. Is it the Fed decision and what they say and do today? Is it whether the US can get to grips with the trouble that's racking the banks at the moment? My view is the latter. I think, you know, that everybody has now tried to really draw a line with First Republic. The big banks have all put deposits in there to try to boost confidence. That hasn't necessarily worked. We're still seeing, you know, kind of people considering the need for more aid or more action to kind of give it that prop. And the concern is that, you know, even if that one's solved, then the market focus just moves on to the next one. So I think being able to short circuit that, get the credit risks under control before there's too much of a contraction, before bank borrowing costs are so high that it starts to really spill into the real economy, is probably the number one thing to be worried about right now. And in fact, in the recent Bank of America survey of market participants, that credit risk and the risk of a contagion from bank to bank is really what investors' number one concern is right now.
Okay, so in terms of the dot plot and projections, the last of which came in December, the debate around forward guidance, will we know any more today? I mean, that is the expectation that we get that.
That's the expectation. Here's a hilarious statistic for you, Caroline, which is that the two-year yield on US Treasuries is actually pretty much exactly where it was at the time of the last Fed meeting. In the interim, of course, we've gone shooting higher and then we've blazed lower and now we're back where we started again. You know, as we were getting towards this, we had some pretty frothy looking inflation data, and the concern was that the Fed would need to get more aggressive, would need to push the peak rate much higher still. Probably the dot plot has got to indicate some concern about that. But at the same time, you know, I would expect that there might be a big range of views, and maybe that gives Powell enough space to hide and say, look, the future path is pretty uncertain. The other option for him is just to take a skip on it altogether, which is what they did 2 years ago during COVID. You know, it's too much uncertainty for us to see, so we're not going to give you any path here. But that, of course, risks causing its own panic and concerns as well.
Paul, we will let you go back to arguing with your colleagues. Thank you very much for your time on the programme this morning. That's Bloomberg's executive editor for Asia Markets, Paul Dobson.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
The former Bank of England policymaker Danny Blanchflower says it would be madness for central banks to raise rates now after the volatility we've seen in the banking sector. Blanchflower is now a professor of economics at Dartmouth. He told us that raising rates further would be reckless.
The volatility and the activities around the globe have essentially resulted in about probably 200 basis points equivalent of tightening. So this volatility has done the Fed's work for it. And I actually think if you have to think of one place, one organization that's responsible for this volatility, that essentially is the cause of this volatility, it's the Fed. Wrongly raised rates, didn't really think of the implications, thought everything would be just fine, and tried to tell everybody, including themselves, that there was going to be a soft landing based upon absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And now we see the consequences.
Was the goal of fighting inflation not necessary that they would try raising rates to bring down inflation?
There was a lot of evidence that actually the inflation was essentially transitory in one sense, that there was a supply shock from COVID and then a second supply shock from the Ukraine war. So the idea that you want to be like Volcker because of exploding wages and because of rising demand was really for the birds. And the groupthink amongst these central bankers was pretty interesting. Essentially, no dissents on the Fed, only in the last meeting or two, some dissents on the MPC. So this was really about, we think we're going to fight inflation, but inflation sort of inevitably was going to fall away as all the prices fell and things came back to normal. But the whole, in a sense, this was, I call it guessonomics. This was essentially a wing and a prayer without really thinking about what the potential consequences on the real economy were. Let's think about what the driver was of the Silicon Valley Bank. It was that tech companies that have been used to relatively low interest rates were suddenly faced with higher interest rates, as was the Silicon Valley Bank that had bought long bonds. So the idea not only that you raise rates, but you raise rates in a dizzying way and convince yourself that it was all absolutely wonderful and the banking system was absolutely fine, given that we had history of that in 2007 and 2008.
Professor Blanchflower, I was speaking to Lord Adair Turner, who was head of the FCA, the UK regulator, at the time, just a few days after the Lehman collapse. And I asked him this question, are we returning to 2008 or is this an extension of the 2008 global financial crisis in some ways, revisited? You're saying that it is. He disagreed with that entirely.
Well, bless Adair. Maybe. I mean, I can remember Northern Rock. And Northern Rock failed in a particular week. The website crashed because people were pulling money out. And essentially, the government had to decide what to do on the Monday morning, whether they would guarantee all deposits. And they had to. And that was exactly a precursor to what happened with Silicon Valley. Janet Yellen sat over the weekend and thought to herself, what can I do? Can I allow this run on the banks to occur? So the answer was, well, they did exactly the same as they did at Northern Rock. So there's an analogy already. And remember that on October the 8th, 2008, the world's central banks acted together as they did this week. So the Canadian central bank, the Japanese central bank, the Swiss central bank, the ECB and the Bank of England acted together to try and calm down global markets. So Adair can say there's no analogy, but we can think of analogies all over the place.
Then you see more concerning areas, more shoes to drop, if you will, but more bank contagion, more problems in other parts of the US, European, UK economies then?
Well, that's the worry. Think of the right strategy. The right strategy is to say, I have concerns about the potential contagion and I have to do everything I can to prevent that contagion. The right tactic is to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. The strategy
is that not what we're seeing regulators doing, though? Is that not what they're doing in this moment?
Well, to some degree, we are. And obviously, the response of Yellen is an appropriate one. We need to make sure that the system is backstopped. But what have we actually learned? We learned with Credit Suisse and the rescue there that first bondholders were going to got wiped out. So that's raised the risk premium around the world. But also that UBS demanded $9 billion fund, Swiss bank fund, to basically deal with the surprises that were in the Credit Suisse books. And I think we have to look back in the UK and say, well, what happened after Trussonomics? Quartey introduced a budget on the Friday, and on Monday, the UK pension industry collapsed, and on Tuesday, the mortgage markets closed. So not only is the worry that that there is contagion, the difficulty is that this contagion and the consequences of it spread very fast. And in a sense, the great football analogy is appropriate. You get your retaliation in first here. You prepare for this and you try and prevent it. The idea that central banks would raise rates this week is, well, I think it would generate a disaster, I would say. That's the danger.
Do you think that that is what the Fed and the Bank of England and a host of other central banks who make decisions this week are actually going to do, though? Do you think that they are going to continue raising rates, as we've discussed, to try to control inflation?
Well, there is obviously some considerable probability that they will do that, and markets are still pricing that in. But there are considerable voices now being raised. I mean, Richard Murphy and I wrote a response to the Treasury Select Committee arguing that basically that they should be cutting by probably 150 at this meeting to try and get retaliation in early. So the issue is, if they're going to raise, the best I suspect we can hope for is that they potentially will pause. And I think pausing is probably the best you can hope for. But the reality is that they should be cutting. Any move upwards would be an enormous error. And what you'll end up seeing is screeching U-turns. And I just have to look at what markets are pricing in. Markets today in the United States are pricing in by the end of the year three rate cuts. So if they're pricing in three rate cuts, suggests that the rate rises today would be foolishness at best and disastrous at worst.
That's Danny Blanchflower, Professor of Economics at Dartmouth and a former member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee.
Up next, Boris Johnson's reckoning. Age is just a number and the EU clears house.
Now, the paper review on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe. The news you need to know from today's papers.
Well, Boris Johnson's testimony to Partygate is on the front of most papers this morning here in the UK, except for The Telegraph, which calls Keir Starmer a hypocrite, and The Financial Times, which is writing about pensions. James Wilcock is with us for the details of what's in the papers today. James, let's start then with Boris Johnson.
Yes, Stephen, I don't want to sort of relitigate the ins and outs of Partygate, mostly because Kitty Donaldson does that on the UK Politics podcast yesterday with Caroline Hepke. But today, Boris Johnson has submitted a 50-page submission to the Commons Privilege Committee, arguing why he didn't break the rules last year. Now, given all the papers are covering this, there are many different angles to explore, but I want to get to the Times because they really break this down into Boris Johnson said on the 1st of December that all the guidance were followed at all times. Now, Martin Reynolds, who was his private principal private secretary at the time, sent over WhatsApp, "You shouldn't say that, Boris, because we should say no rules were broken." Now, it's an important distinction, but they were kind of trying to caveat quite how it happened. So even in their testimony, there is this kind of distinction here. And what this hearing comes down to today, after about a year of waiting for sort of various Sugrey reports and inquiries, is did Boris Johnson lie to Parliament? And if that is found to have happened, there are serious consequences for him. He might lose his seat. He might lose the Tory whip. But what is more important for the government of the day now is this is almost serving to be a bit of a lightning rod for criticism of Rishi Sunak. You're seeing sort of a wave of sort of anti-Sunak sentiment this week, from the ERG having a go at his Brexit deal to DUP saying that they also won't back it. And now Johnson is set to sort of steal the thunder and make the attention all on him again. And as a reminder, Rishi Sunak was fined for Partygate too. So this isn't a topic that he particularly wants to be revisiting.
No, absolutely. Do listen to Kitty Donaldson, because we had a long conversation on the UK Politics podcast, as you mentioned, James, yesterday about it. She's just absolutely fascinating. And she was saying that there perhaps is an element of schadenfreude amongst the Sunak allies. She says that basically the Prime Minister is going to try to keep his head down, perhaps, you know, re-emerge at the weekend once all of this Boris Johnson drama is out of the way. And yet, you know, she says it's sort of revisiting an immensely painful period in Britain's past, you know, going back to kind of Partygate and what officials, although she was quite sympathetic about what the officials were doing at the time. You know, they didn't realise how it was going to look, was her view. Anyway, that aside, let's move on and talk about pensions, the story in the FT. We will watch Boris Johnson a bit later, but what about the pensions story?
I mean,
story?
This is the thing, right? It's all encompassing, that Boris Johnson story. But what is fascinating is pensions as well. The Telegraph, when they called Starmer a hypocrite, was all about his pensions cap. So it is really starting to dominate the headlines, where the FT are saying ministers have delayed plans to raise the state pension age to 68 amid falling life expectancy in the UK. Now, that review comes up at May 7th, and maybe they're looking to France, where we've been covering from the age going up from 62 to 64 and seeing this cause massive discontent. But as well as that, this raises the question of where the government finds its money. If it's not going to up the pension age, how is it going to get it? John Stepek, our sort of fiscal whiz guru, points out here that maybe it's fiscal drag that gets you, because by freezing income tax and national insurance thresholds, the government's set to raise nearly £30 billion a year in taxes by 2027. So maybe what the calculation here is, well, we're actually taxing you in other ways, let's not cause this political bomb by raising the state pension age. But that's certainly what the FT think is going on behind the scenes.
Certainly we're all being dragged by the tax man in some way or another. James, let's go to The Telegraph next. Writing about Brexit, the impact of Brexit on the City of London in some colourful language.
Yes, I look at our reporting of how Brexit has shifted a lot of the crowns of London's finance over to the EU, and then compared to some of the Telegraph's wording, they call it a plot by Brussels to shift the City of London's lucrative clearing market to the continent. It's anti-competitive and it will increase costs, European investors have warned. So the reason why this is interesting and not just a plot is that it is European fund and asset managers who have written to Europe's sort of authorities saying actually putting in place barriers to trade here won't help the bottom line and won't be good for business, so it won't do so. But what
rather than just worrying about it and calling it a plot, what is fascinating here is the bloc is looking to try and reassure risk. There's a great piece on Bloomberg by Nick Comfort out this morning saying all the people who have moved over to Europe are being asked by European regulators to check that their regulations are up to scratch in the wave of this financial risk, because actually it's not about just money moving, it's about European regulators being certain that their money is safe because they don't have as much control over them.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, your morning brief on the stories making news from London to Wall Street and beyond.
Look for us on your podcast feed every morning on Apple, Spotify and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
You can also listen live each morning on London DAB Radio, the Bloomberg Business app and Bloomberg.com.
Our flagship New York station is also available on your Amazon Alexa devices. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Join us again tomorrow morning for all the news you need to start your day, right here on Bloomberg Daybreak Europe.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.